This is The Poet and the Poem from the Library of Congress. I am Grace Cavalieri, and Maria Tarone is here, and she has a new book from WordWorks, and she's going to tell us the title, and she's going to read a poem. Maria, hi. What is the title of this new book from WordWorks?
It's called No Known Coordinates.
Well, we're going to find out what all that means with a poem, please.
Sure. I'm going to begin with the first one in the book, and the title is Under the L. Sun slanted down through the slats of the elevated train onto my fat baby hand that held a shadow-tarnished toy. Light and dark poured out in equal measure. From my carriage, I saw its tracks across my skin, and everywhere my gaze fell, lamppost, cracked pavement, the faces of strangers. I saw how light and dark could shift into a new pattern, and then how that pattern could lift away. I saw, without knowledge, the flux we're born to. My mother's face stayed hidden as she pushed me through the East Harlem market, my fist holding, then releasing its fleeting tattoo.
You know, I was reading that poem, Maria, and I wondered if you set the tone for the collection of poems with that and how that kind of frames your life. Is a poet a noticer from the beginning? Is that what that means?
Yes, I think so. I think it was chosen because it sets the tone. And yes, I do agree that observation is absolutely essential to a poet's art. This was one of my very first childhood memories. Obviously, I was in a carriage, but I remember it still.
Well, a recent memory is your connection with the Museum of Modern Art in New York. How
yes.
did you happen to be their poster girl on Instagram?
Well, it's really funny. Some years ago, I loved the Museum of Modern Art, and I was in their sculpture garden and just enjoying the day. And I saw someone who was a dear friend who had passed many years earlier. This person looked like his double, and I was inspired to write a poem called In the Sculpture Garden. Then the Museum of Modern Art reached out to its members asking to describe unusual experiences. I sent them the poem, they loved it, and they invited me to come in to read that poem right in the setting of the Sculpture Garden. So it was really thrilling.
That is so, it's really in a way unusual. And that you should send it in and that it should be really appreciated because they might have gotten thousands of poems.
Yeah, I have no idea how many they received, but they said, we loved your ghost story.
How cool. Well, we love your poetry, and that's why we want to hear another one.
Okay.
And in fact, I think we could have two.
Okay, sure. Well, I'll read one, which is called The White Piano. How it floated in the townhouse, whose glass facade was not a window, but a lens through which I peered. How it glowed against the dark of the other rooms, against the gloom of that hour, slick as a luxury ship on the sea of winter, the bleak cold of a city street. How solid, and yet ethereal, as if suspended on clear thread, the dangled promise of another life. I stood before it waiting, but how still its bone-white fingers remained, how relentlessly empty that room.
Before you go on to the next one, I have to say I honor your vowels. I honor your consonants. You really know how to put them together. I'll tell you, let's hear the next.
Okay, thank you. The next one, still taking place in the city, is called Birdman, and it begins with an epigraph by the Beatles. You were only waiting for this moment to be free. Lennon McCartney, Blackbird. As a Bronx kid at a homeless shelter, he watched a peregrine falcon devour a pigeon on the windowsill. And what began in violence leapt to awe, and awe begat beauty. He's grown to be a birder who shares our passion. Through the lens, he sights a warbler and the flash of a goldfinch who's migrated north, whispering his excitement. And yet, he remains apart, that rare species among us. For unlike us, when alone, he must take the greatest care removing binoculars from his backpack, must handle them slowly, keeping them in full view, for they are black, the color and size of a gun. Am I wrong to think of him as a blackbird? No, a starling, iridescent, grazing the earth at dusk and dawn in city parks, but gazing up, not down. But he also peers into the dense hiding places he knows well, the shadow cover where the living must sometimes take refuge to stay alive.
Oh, Maria, do you know that compassion is the highest spiritual principle? Even above love. Compassion, to put yourself in another person's place. But when you look at everything you're writing, what is the story that the whole collection, No Known Coordinates, gives us? I mean, Camus says writers are always writing the same story over and over. What is your story you're always saying? I mean, I know I am.
Yeah, I mean, I think at this stage, this is my fourth full collection of poetry, there is certainty and there's more of a search for meaning. I think poets are always looking for meaning. I think there's a philosophical bent to this, but I don't want to turn people off by that word because I feel that images are so important. So the title kind of says it all. No Known Coordinates, I'm looking, I'm searching.
That is excellent. Here's where the title fits the book, really. But do you think poetry is a lighthouse in your life?
Absolutely.
It is in mine. We can tell that with your work. So let's have another poem.
Okay, so this poem is the only one that I pulled out from my very first book, which was called The Bodies We Were Loaned. That was also from the Word Works. And it's called Madame Curie, about the great scientist. Even through her cheap boots, she felt something shift below the earth, and her skin tingled, 1,000 tiny bombs exploding in on through her fingertips, belly, hips, the very roots of her scalp. Even picking mushrooms, she saw the glowworms and fireflies throb brighter as she neared. When her mother died, she gave up her bed to boarders, stoked their last embers, boiled their pierogi. She tended rich children, charges that circled her like a planet's moons. Even gravity stopped trying to hold her down. Science whispered in her ear, stirred her, pulled her across every border to Paris and Pierre. How they pulsed, huddled together in the lab with a box of radium, watching rays burst free and split into alpha, beta, gamma. How they beamed at the Folies Bergère, all those legs rising and falling like happy electrons. Thin, squinting men in top hats heaped prizes on them. Even when a streetcar's wheels rumbled by to claim Pierre, Magna pushed on, an engine doing its work. She rigged x-rays on vans to see the wounds of war, killed tumors, burned skin off her fingers. She glowed, she believed in the triumph of good. Even when her great heart stopped pumping, needles jumped beyond their scales.
Oh, the triumph of good. How did you ever occupy that persona? And didn't that receive some great notability, that poem?
Well, I still remember the feeling of being on cloud nine when Poetry Magazine accepted this poem for publication, because I was really just beginning to get serious about writing poetry and sending it out. And it actually was the result of an assignment from my poetry mentor, later friend, Enid Shomer, to write a poem related to a scientist. And I didn't know anything about Madame Curie. So I did some research, and this was
That's
the result.
What I tell my students, that research really for historical figures is so important. It gives, but beyond that, there's something more than facts in that poem. There's a lot of Maria. What do you think that tenacity that I see in there and that passion, that doesn't come from language, that comes from the writer of language. What do you think you have in that persona, or what we must have in a persona?
You know, I think in order to be successful in anything, you know, whether it's poetry or painting or whatever you do in life, you need that tenacity and that passion. And Madame Curie was such a wonderful example of that. I mean, science happened to be her passion, and she carried it forth, even though she lost her life because of it. You know, she was exposed to cancer, you know, through her work, but she was just an indomitable woman.
Do you think you're going to be good at other persona poems?
Oh, I love writing persona poems. I love the chance to become the voice of someone else. And I have gone from one extreme to another. The Hudson Review published a poem of mine called "The Egyptian Queen Gives Death the Slip." And that was inspired by a visit to the museum, the Metropolitan Museum, their mummy exhibit. And then I've been the voice of a 14-year-old girl at the turn of the century who works in a glass factory. That was inspired by a photo exhibit of childhood workers. So, you know, it could be anyone. And I find it thrilling to be able to put myself in that person's shoes. Sometimes it's a male that I...
You're so good. I was going to ask you that. I remember the glass factory. And so what male do you remember having written about? Anyway, I think you need to do a book of persona poems, or put them all together, or else write a play, because your characters are very complicated, and they are really... because of the complexity, we believe it. You know, it isn't just pasting a caricature on the page. So we're beginning to know you better and better, and we will know you even more with two poems.
Okay.
And the book is No Known Coordinates. And I want to tell everyone that this is your fourth book, and that you have won these awards. I have to say these. The McGovern Prize, from Ashland Poetry Press, the WordWorks, she has two chapbooks and four complete collections of poems. She has won the Eleanor Benedict Prize, the Ellen Tate Memorial Prize, the Mathiasen Prize, and so let's win another prize.
Okay.
Keep going.
All right. This is a sonnet that relates to me and my mother and our relationship ultimately. And it's called Handbag. Strap grafted onto her forearm, it swung like a clock's pendulum as my mother walked, or more precisely, strode farther and faster than anyone else. She belonged to herself alone and marked time to that swing and jangle within, bag locked with the sound of a vault closing to block marauders. Hijab, blanket, bank, anodyne, purse to heart clutch or cradle, slab of black leather impenetrable, secret mother lode unreachable, protector of the code unbreakable. Yet, when I fell and cracked my skull, she ran to me. It flew from her grip and lay abandoned by a wall, mouth agape.
So interesting to use an object. Objects have vibrations, don't they?
Oh, yes.
That is very good to... We get a portrait from that object, and I get a portrait of your mother.
Yes, who is 100 and a half as we speak, and still living at home, 24/7 aides, and lives three blocks away, and still is sharp. So I'm very blessed and grateful.
You have a lot going on. You've been the poetry editor for Italiana Americana, and I have three questions about that.
Okay.
One, how do you select the poems? Two, how do you manage to pick a poem that's different from your own aesthetic, which would be hard? And three, how do you actually judge a poem? So we'll start with number one. How do you think you represent yourself in a scholarly magazine as the poetry editor? There, that's five and six. I'll start. How do you think a poetry editor is necessary in a scholarly edition?
Well, I think there has to be an overarching aesthetic, but the fact is, you know, I do have the final say, but I am very lucky that I have two assistant poetry editors, and one of them, I think his aesthetic is quite different from mine. He helps me see things that I might not have seen. Mm. And sometimes, you know, we have very interesting discussions. What we do is we all get the poem simultaneously. We all make up our own lists of like the top 10, 12, whatever. We compare notes. Very often there's a lot of overlap. But the fun part for me is the discussion. And sometimes, you know, I say, yeah, you know, you're right. I didn't see that. So it's great to have these two people working with me. And I'm really glad. Italian Americana is one of, I think, the oldest Italian American literary and scholarly journal. It's in its 50th year. So we hope to keep it going for another 50 years.
It has been in my life ever since I've been a writer, and in everyone else's too. It's a very significant magazine because it has essays, it has historicity, yeah, as well as art. So now a poem.
Okay, this is a short one. You know, we're always bombarded with video images. So I ended up writing this one called Lost in Acres of Corn. Yet another video on my computer screen. 12 hours she was missing. Overnight, a three-year-old and her dog. Towering blades so dense they blocked the light. To be lost in such a story, knowing its ending, grace and joy. To be lost in my own story, not knowing who might be searching for me in the maze. Shall I curl up in darkness as the child did and sleep? Shall I awaken and rise in first light to find myself?
Isn't that about self-discovery in writing?
Yes, I think that's one interpretation, to find myself. Yeah. I mean, when I was writing this, I had originally ended it with the stanza before, shall I curl up in darkness as the child did and sleep? I didn't want to end it on sleep, though. So I think this final concluding, you know, very short paragraph stanza really made all the difference.
Yes,
awaken and rise in first light to find myself.
For that reason, I'd like you to read it again.
Sure. Lost in acres of corn. Yet another video on my computer screen. 12 hours she was missing. Overnight, a three-year-old and her dog. Towering blades so dense they blocked the light. To be lost in such a story, knowing its ending, grace and joy. To be lost in my own story, not knowing who might be searching for me in the maze. Shall I curl up in darkness as the child did and sleep? Shall I awaken and rise in first light to find myself?
What I like about that is the self-discovery that we embark on every time we put the pen to paper. We are truly lost until we clear the atmosphere and get something on the desk that will stay there, it seems to me. And Bob Hickok was saying, when he starts a poem, he never knows how it's going to end. Well, mm-hmm. I can't always say that's my process. But there is something about his trust in the journey that makes his work very unpredictable and full of surprises. But that poem, to me, really represents a lot more than maybe you even intended. Do you think that's a bonus plus thing about being a writer, that
oh, yeah,
gets more out of it than you knew?
Absolutely. I, like Bob Hickok, I usually do not know how my poem is going to end. And that is the joy of writing, just discovering yourself in the process of doing writing. And then, of course, it does go through lots and lots of revisions. But there's nothing to me that equals that spark of just joy when you feel something new that's just fallen from your muse, you know, and it's wonderful. Can't describe.
Who I really am.
Mm-hmm.
Who I really am. Guess what? Each poem tells me, you know, I can't tell you how profound I think that is. I don't think it's just a craft thing. I think it is really, when people say, you know, why poetry? Well, why get in touch with the spirit? You know, why find out what's connected to your heart? I mean, we know we don't get paid for this, but how do you explain to people the value of living on that level, even though it doesn't have to be elevated language, but to put yourself in a place where you start an idea and take it through your veins and find out what is your secret yearning. That's what I get from that poem. And it's a little poem. It packs a lot.
Yeah, thank you. Yeah, take it through your veins. I like that phrase. It really resonates for me.
You really do it. What does WordWorks say about your book? They like it?
Well, yeah, they chose to publish it. So
But you've done work with them before.
Yes, my very first book, The Bodies We Were Loaned, was with WordWorks. The WordWorks, yeah.
Let us have another poem, please. Maria Tyrone.
Okay, so this is set in our neighborhood in Queens, in Jackson Heights, and it's called Your Blood Was No Longer on the Stone Under the Tree When I Returned to the Scene Today, which didn't surprise me after last night's rain. But still, I wanted to go back to see for myself, alone this time, no longer within the circle of five good Samaritans, their cell phones pulled from pockets and bags, that calloused hand outstretched to lift you up, the young Honduran woman who insisted on walking us to our door, her arm linked through yours on one side, mine grasping the other. A kindness that washed over us like the blessing of a downpour after searing heat. I knelt before that tree, under its budding leaves, that bloodied stone, unstained now, pale gray on its patch of earth, oddly grateful for the wound that brought strangers to us and me to you as you lay later on our bed. When I emailed the person who'd escorted us home, offering my thanks again, coffee or lunch if she had the time, she didn't reply. She'd vanished into our neighborhood of immigrants, most ignored by longtime residents like us, some praised, others maligned. Angels act and disappear, Father Santo said when I told our story, a smile crossing his face. And I wondered if priests speak of angels with irony. But I know this person in her white high tops walks and falls to the same earth we do, this stranger who wanted no thanks, nameless and numinous.
You know, you really can read. And I was trying to tell somebody the secret, and it's about punching those vowels. You know, you really do. You know, did you, someone teach you that, or did you just happen to know? Five good Samaritans. I mean, you really do highlight every vowel and emphasize it, and that makes it, that's motion. And I wondered if you had trained for theater.
No, I'm flattered that you suggest that. No one trained me. I think, you know, I do a lot of practicing of my poems. I read my poems aloud, even when I'm writing them. And then when they're finished, it's like I discover what are the essential words to emphasize in a poem. I had never thought that it's emphasizing the vowels. So thank you for that observation. I hadn't really been aware of that.
When you write when you go to read, do you put little highlights in a pen over the words, or do you just automatically know?
Sometimes I do highlight.
This is a lesson. This is a lesson for professional poets. I'm telling you, they can just sync themselves with their readings. Don't you agree?
Yeah, unfortunately.
True. You're just too nice. You're too nice to say it. Well, I know you do a lot of work with writers in the schools, the writers in the school project. What is that? Under what umbrella? And what have you been doing?
Well, this is a wonderful program that the Hudson Review, which has published me and supported me over the years, they have funding to bring their authors into New York City public schools and to read their work. And the nice part is that they work with English teachers who receive copies of the poems ahead of time, so the students have a chance to be familiar with them. Then when the writer comes, they usually have great questions. I've gotten so much satisfaction from participating in this.
What is the grade level?
It could vary, but in general, they're high school. Yeah, I think they've always been high school, actually. One was
the young.
That would
make sense. That would make sense.
Yeah, yeah.
For the understanding. Yeah, well,
one was the Young Women's Leadership School, that was all girls, but they've been, mixed. One was an international school, all new arrivals to New York City, and they had fabulous questions, So, it's just been, I love it. I love it when Paula Dietz, the editor, invites me to do this.
Are you going to continue?
Oh, yeah, I would love to.
Well, we're getting to know you, and if people will get your new book, No Known Coordinates, they will actually find some coordinates within themselves. So I want to tell you that Maria is a native New Yorker and lives with her husband in Jackson Heights and sounds like all my cousins.
Yes, and I can't do anything about my Queens accent. Sorry.
I love it. I feel family. So let's have a final poem.
Not an Autumn Elegy. Sky and clouds peek through the leaves of this once lush bush, now riddled with holes. Mesmerized, I gaze from below, wondering if this fragile yellow lace, already curling to ash, could actually hold the firmament. Imagine a woman adrift on a life raft, eyes raised, clinging to the hope of distant stars. Nearby, someone has placed a cross-section of our once towering maple. I wish I knew how to read these rings encircling the dark planet at the tree's core. 50 years here? 100? Yet so smooth on my palm and slightly damp, as if its sap still flowed right into my lifeline.
Clinging to the hope of distant stars. This is The Poet and the Poem from the Library of Congress, and that was the voice of Maria Tyrone. We are produced by Forest Woods Media Productions, post-production by Mike Turpin, MET Studios. We wish to thank the Library of Congress for making the program possible. Funding is provided by the Sinipet Fund, the Rivada Foundation of the Logan family, and friends of the program, Natalie Canivore and Sandy Jackson Cohen. Mike Turpin's our engineer, and I'm Grace Cavalieri.